The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been meditating for over 40 years, and I still marvel at meditation, marvel at what happens. And it's been a wonderful journey that I'm probably wouldn't trade for almost anything. And one of the marvels is not what I do, but what happens when I meditate. What is done to me, in a sense. And what I have in mind this evening to try to talk about is probably best maybe represented by an analogy. So a few times in this lifetime, I've taken up some kind of exercise, like running or swimming, sometimes hiking. And there's a common phenomena, at least for me, of doing these things. When I pick them up, I have this idea. It's a good idea. And then I start doing it and I don't like it. And it seems like it's a little bit rough and my lungs don't quite work. And it seems like a lot of work, a lot of effort has to go in. And, you know, I could feel for me, you know, I'm not in shape and I kind of don't want to do it. And I have to kind of use my will to override the desire to stop. Something like that. And then times like I've done it every day or very regularly, then over time, you know, usually relatively quickly, the first week or so, somehow the lungs get into shape and it becomes easier. And it's not so much resistance to running. It seems like I just, just kind of, okay, I'm doing this. And it still work, but it just, you know, it seems like things are clicking together and I don't have to work so hard at breathing like I did at the beginning or something. And then if I keep doing it and doing it, after a while, part of it becomes easier and easier. And for me, with running, sometimes I thought the first 50, it's like always the first yards, 50 yards, something was a little bit, you know, took some willpower or something. But then it kind of, you know, I kind of settled in. And there was this, after a while, there was this feeling of, sometimes it felt like it was effortless to run for part of it. But there was a feeling of that almost like I was being run, almost like that something clicked in, the energy clicked in, the breathing clicks in, somehow the muscles click in, and then it's not so much work at all to do anymore, and I kind of like it. It's nice, and there's often a very nice feeling of for a while, and then after a while I get tired, and then it gets hard. But for a while, it just kind of everything's kind of flowing in the flow of it all, or something. And then the more I do it, at some point, when I get into this flow, it just feels very easy and good and obvious to be in the present moment. I might be thinking, but the thinking is like so peripheral to what's going on. The real thing is I'm really present. Every step, every breath, every kind of thing going on, the movements of the body, everything comes kind of alive, and I'm just right there with those things. And there's this feeling of lightness, of energy going through me, of attention, a certain kind of joy or delight, ease, something for a while. But I'm not Superman, so eventually, I got tired and different things would kick in. But, it was quite a wonderful feeling. So that's an analogy for what can happen in meditation. That if you're new to meditation, for some people who start new, there's resistance and a lot of ideas that, you know, this is crazy or I can't do it or all kinds of things will kick in and the body will be uncomfortable. And, the body aches and screams and I remember sometimes having this when I was new to meditation, a sensation in my legs that I had never knew before, But there's a distinct sensation of wanting to bolt. You know, you want to run away or something. And so there's that. But then I do it every day. And then when I started, I did it every day. And as I did it, all kinds of things began to shift. And kind of imperceptibly at first, but, you know, after a few weeks or months and year, you know, all these changes started going. The body started to get conditioned, just like with running. There's some of the tightness of the body loosened, and some of the places I was weak got stronger. And it's kind of a little bit got aligned, got settled, and sitting in this posture became, with time, one of my favorite postures to sit in. If someone had told me when I was 20, when I started, that this would be a favorite posture, I would have told them that they were crazy. You know, I had so much pain and fire and aches and all that. And so I kept doing it. Not only was the body got into condition, but the mind got into condition. And I was able to kind of settle in, and all the ways in which I had resistance and doubts and all the criticism I had for myself and all these feelings of, you know, my usual habits, a way of being that really were interfering with meditation, I got to see them and recognize them, and they quieted down and slowed down. And after a while, it became like with running, kind of you got into the flow. And it just feels like your things are flowing sometimes and really there. And sometimes, just like with running or swimming, it's very much in the present moment. It's really here, every breath, every sensation, sound, you know, everything going on. And it was exquisite to have that. And it didn't feel like a lot of work. It wasn't like I had to work at it anymore. It wasn't so much I had to use an act of will anymore. Even though, like with running, you get into the flow. I guess if you measure the energy expended, it'd be a lot of energy. But the psychic energy involved seemed like it was very little. It wasn't any will involved or forcefulness involved. It was just like the most natural thing to do for a period of time in running. So meditation also can settle down and become like that, and it becomes kind of easy to do. It becomes, you get into the flow, maybe not the first 5 minutes, but, you know, you get concentrated and get settled. And slowly over time, a lot of the kinks in the mind work themselves out. There's a wonderful analogy, another analogy that I like from yoga practice. There's a pose called a triangle, where you kind of stand with your legs kind of at a, you know, wide, like a V or something, like upside down V. And then you kind of lean over from one side on your hips, and you without bending your knees, you put your hand down on the floor, and the other hand goes up towards the ceiling. But your one hand goes down and touches the floor. And many people can't do it, and so the yoga teacher will put blocks there. And so you can have your hands on the blocks, and you get support. So there's I heard once of this technique. Is back when there was telephone books, you would get a stack of telephone books, and you'd put them, instead of a block, you'd get all these telephone books, and put them on the floor, and then you would until your hand can go down and touch them if you bent over. So that's good. And then every day you tear out one telephone page, one page. And those telephone books in the old days were very thin pages. So, you know, you don't really notice from one day to the next that you're doing any difference, makes any difference whatsoever. It seems like, you know, it's so little. But every day you pull a page off, and every day, you're actually going teeny bit further down. And over, I don't know how many pages you have to do, 300 pages or 1,000 pages. You know, eventually you get through all those pages and all the telephone books you have, and your hand goes to the floor. And so meditation is that way too. It's like a lot of the changes that happen are incremental, where we learn to let go, we learn not to be so preoccupied, we learn not to get caught up in our concerns, we learn the body itself settles in, the breathing actually settles in also and opens up in meditation, the posture kind of changes. There's all these psychological, emotional, maybe spiritual, physical changes that happen to develop kind of a yogic body and a kind of yogic mind that happens, often very, very gradual. so gradual that if you're looking for progress day by day, it'll be hopeless. Just like those, you know, little thin pages, you know, that's not going anywhere. But if you do it every day, things settle in and settle in and settle in. So for some people, it's a slow process. I think everyone, for some of it, is a slow process that comes steadily working out, you know. And if, you know, these swimmers who practice. I kind of marvel at swimmers. Some of them do the same movements over and over and over again for years. A friend of my son's, he grew up with, is now a college-level swimmer, and, you know, swims and swims and swims. But I think what happens partly is you get stronger, but there's these incremental little shifts and changes in the stroke. The stroke becomes more and more efficient. But it's almost like maybe you have a coach who tells you, you know, turn your hand a little bit this way or do that, this and that. But I suspect some of it is just intuitive. The body knows, will figure it out if you do it often enough. Your body figures out the physics of the hand and the water. But you have to do it a lot for all these shifts and changes to happen. So sometimes meditation is that way. There's all those changes. Sometimes the change can be dramatic. Sometimes people sit down to meditate. Sometimes it's the first time they sit down to meditate. And they've never done anything like this before. And their habitual mind is a mind that's been spinning in thoughts and concerns and fears and imaginations for so long. And they have never thought there was anything else. And they're revved up. The mind is kind of like going in, like an engine. And someone tells them, sit down and focus on your breathing and settle down. And lo and behold, something gets quiet that's never been quiet before. And it's a revelation. Wow. I had no idea. Now I'm living in a new world. Wow. And there's some people who have that kind of beginner's luck the first time they meditate. I had it the first 2 weeks that I meditated. It's like, wow. But it's kind of like, you know, it's sometimes the novelty of it for beginners is so interesting. You know, it's like, you know, you're involved in one of the great world religions, the great, you know, it's very exciting and it's full of promise and, you know, if you're into that thing, kind of thing. And so you get pulled into it, and then it was great, but then after a while, that initial kind of honeymoon phase, and then after a while, I was just left with myself, as opposed to left with all the promise and grandeur of it all. And then the work starts, day in and day out. At some point, different people for different points, it's a marvel. What I marvel at what can happen is that it feels like we're being meditated, and we get out. We learn how to get out of the way, and you can't get out of the way when you're resisting it and you're fighting it and all that. But as you get into it more and more, that you start recognizing that acts of will no longer make any sense. The idea of insisting and discipline and just showing up, it doesn't make any sense to do it anymore because it actually goes in the wrong direction. It makes the mind agitated. And the idea that I'm the doer, it's up to me, I have to do this, and I better do a good job, and I have high expectations of myself, what's supposed to happen. All that is seen as being besides the point and not really needed. And so all kinds of ways in which we're the doer of meditation falls away. But if you tell someone, never meditated before, come and sit down, don't do anything. It's like telling someone, you know, to go out there on the tracks to go running and just sit down. You know, you have to initially make some effort to get the energy going, to get everything aligned, to get conditioned, to learn how to let go, to recognize what has to be let go of, how to get out of the way. But after a while, we learn to get out of the way, while at the same time, the system is engaged and present. And then at some point, there's these marvelous things that can begin happening. There's a beautiful, another like a simile that's used by the Buddha to describe an aspect of this that would be something akin to having a, like a geyser, a fount of water coming out of the ground, it has its plug in it. If you pull the plug, the geyser comes and all this water flows out. The way the Buddha said it, it was not like a geyser, but rather an underwater spring. And at the bottom of the lake, there is the spring water is flowing into the lake. And as it flows from the middle of the bottom, it flows upwards and spreads out into the lake in a kind of a gentle current that comes up, just flows like a fountain of water coming through the water. And at some point, that's what it feels like in meditation. It feels like the fountain is operating or the flow is happening, and it's just arising and flowing, moving through us. It's a beautiful analogy. And the Buddha, back at his time, recognized all this, and he talked about how certain things begin arising on their own, a natural process that when certain conditions are in place, then something begins to take over that's quite beautiful, quite wonderful, quite helpful. And in order for these wonderful things to kind of kick into place, he says they're based on something. Just like he said, human or all legged creatures, they walk, they stand, they sit, they lie down, all based, all dependent on the earth that they're standing on. In the same way, these marvelous things that can flow out in meditation, that can grow and can develop, they are all built on the foundation, dependent on virtue. So the idea of having certain kind of inner, some people like the word integrity, ethical integrity, no longer doing things with the mind, with the body, with the mouth, that are involved agitating the mind, constricting the mind, conflicting the mind, the heart, the kind of things of causing intentional harm to the world around us. This idea of kind of cleaning up the ethics, our virtue, is a foundation necessary for these marvelous things to happen. So it's not just a matter of sitting down to meditate and then going around robbing banks all day when you're not meditating. There has to be, you know, some kind of purification or cleaning of one's ethical life to make this work. And then so there's this thing, these things start to arise. And so, oddly enough, for people who do mindfulness practice, the way it's talked about here in the West, mindfulness itself is not described as something that's done, but mindfulness is something that arises based on our ability to keep observing what's going on. So there's two different things in the ancient language. There's observation, and there's what's sati, there's mindfulness. And if we really keep showing up, what's here, and seeing what's here, seeing, really being present, seeing what's in our body, seeing our feelings, seeing the states of the mind, seeing the mental processes that are operating, and the important things being said, just see it. So for the body, it said, seeing the body in the body in the body. See the body just as a body. Just see what's there, very, very simply. Without judgments, without associated thinking, without commentary, just kind of see things in and of themselves without being for or against anything, to cultivate that ability just to see what's there. As we do that, something gets born. And what gets born is a kind of a higher quality or higher kind of awareness that one teacher I know calls a lucid awareness, that he uses Bhikkhu Bodhi, a famous translator, who describes sati, the word that we now translate as mindfulness, as lucid awareness, that something gets arise and gets born. The Buddha describes this arising of something like this that happens, that we don't do, but we create the conditions for it to happen over time. He calls it, he uses the word sati for it, mindfulness, but he calls it mindfulness the factor of awakening of mindfulness, the mindfulness factor of awakening. And he has seven of these different qualities called factors of awakening. And these are these seven fountains, these seven things that kind of flow if we get out of the way. But if we have, you know, we have to do the practice, we have to do our work to get there. So these seven are the mindfulness factor of awakening. Usually in English we say the investigation factor of awakening, the energy factor of awakening, the rapture factor of awakening, the tranquility factor of awakening, the concentration factor of awakening, and the equanimity factor of awakening. So mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. These are beautiful, beautiful states, the beautiful fountains that can arise, or states that kind of spread and be there. But the thing that's so marvelous and so remarkable is how these things can arise kind of as gifts. We don't construct them. We don't make them. We create the conditions for them to be there. We kind of do house cleaning of our hearts and our minds. We cultivate the ability slowly over time by taking one telephone page off at a time, of cleansing, of freeing the mind and the heart. And as the mind and the heart get freer and freer, then these states begin to become stronger and stronger. Now the point of all that in the teachings of the Buddha is not to have these nice states. And there's no state that is the point for the Buddha. But rather, why they're called factors of awakening is that they lead to awakening. They create the condition. They arise because of the presence of certain conditions, but they themselves are the conditions that support the mind or the heart to relax enough, to feel safe enough, to trust enough, to feel confident enough, to be able to release and let go the deepest fears that we hold, the deepest attachments we have, the deepest preoccupations, the deepest attachments to even existence and living, the attachments to identity and being someone or not being someone, and all these things, that all these kind of fundamental attachments that are kind of the basis of many people's how they live their lives, to be able to put those to rest is not an easy thing to do. And so there's a lot of support that's needed for that. And for the Buddha, an important part of the support is to allow these deeper states to come up, to kind of condition or inspire or settle the heart so it can finally feel safe just to let go, just to be. And it's a marvelous thing to kind of feel that this process happens, you know, this whole idea of self that speaks, such a complicated, complex world, self, me, myself, and mine, who I think I am, how I think people see me, how I want to be seen, the identities I hold on to, all these things, it's a complicated world that our society around us supports us to have and to be and to defend and to project and to hold on to. To have all these preoccupations with self quiet down or be seen through or no longer be the reference point for how we go through our lives is a fantastic thing to also. And part of the idea of meditation and this idea of this conditionings opening up to the flow or some other process unfolding that we get out of the way of is support for this idea of popping the bubble of me, myself, and mine. This idea of self that's supposed to, you know, we think it's we're at the center of who we are. And to be able to be present for this world without this little or big, I wanted to say splinter that we carry with us. The splinter of self-identity and attachment. It's just a marvelous thing. And to get out of your own way that way and to feel the freedom of it. So one of the reasons I'm giving this talk is that as people meditate, there's a play between two different related phenomena. One is what we do and what we allow to happen. So there's certainly we have to do something. And if you're brand new, for example, maybe you have to do a lot. If you're really agitated or something difficult's happened in your life, it might take a lot of work to corral the mind, the thoughts, the preoccupation, really show up and be here, be with what's going on. There might be a lot of strong emotions and emotional difficulties that are present and, you know, because of what's going on in life. And it might take a lot of compassion and care and effort to be present for oneself. And it takes work. So there are times when meditation is work. And there's what we do. But there's also necessary to have an attitude that it's not just all about doing. It's not about me doing something or me getting something. There also has to be an getting out of the way and allowing something to happen. Without making space for something to happen, there's maybe nothing can happen. So, if the mind is filled with thoughts, there's no room for anything different to happen. And one of the reasons why we let the thinking quiet down in meditation or let go of our thoughts is so that there's room for something different to arise and to happen. And getting concentrated, being settled, feeling joy, feeling a lightness, feeling calm. All those things, it's kind of like those things can arise for us if there's room in the mind for that to happen. So it's not just a matter of letting go of thoughts, but it's also letting go of our thoughts or quieting them down and letting go into kind of space, into quiet or silence, where the mind is not incessantly thinking and doing and wanting. They're spinning around in its little whirlwinds of preoccupations. And so there has to be, how can we offer ourselves, or how can we also do this allowing piece? There's what we do, and then there's the allowing for something to happen. There's the making space so that something, and then getting out of the way so something can come into that space. Something can surface and come through. And this combination of those two is the, you know, kind of describes the process of meditation. And sometimes the balance is more towards doing, and sometimes the balance is more towards not doing, but rather allowing. And we go back and forth. And it is not just in deep meditation where these, you know, marvelous seven factors of awakening arising that we allow. Sometimes the very profound work of psychological healing or emotional healing that we have to do works very much the same way, where we have to, there's something we have to do, sometimes there's a lot of doing when there's a lot of inner turmoil and pain, but it's also, we have to also allow for something to operate within us, allow it to flow, something to flow, sometimes the pain to flow, the strong emotions to flow, the grief to flow. And we have to make room for that to come up. And so figuring out what the right balance is between doing and allowing. Sometimes it's too much to allow, and maybe what's needed is a grounding meditation or compassion meditation. But other times, the most healing thing we can do is get completely out of the way and let the difficult emotions just flow through us. So this balance between the doing and the allowing. And as we do this meditation practice, if you do it regularly, maybe every day, and so that you can have the experience of, you know, pulling away one telephone book page at a time, that people will learn to do, what people will learn is a deeper and deeper trust or confidence in this process of allowing things to move through. And whether it's very difficult and painful things to have them come through, or whether it's these marvelous things that come through, it doesn't matter. to the meditative mind, what matters is more is that the confidence we have in the allowing, of getting out of the way, that we it's okay. Actually, it's very healthy to let the forces within us, the unfolding within us, to make room for it. Because it seems that our inner life is smarter than we are. What do you think of that? The little piece of you that you think that you identify as, the control tower, who's in charge and knows what's supposed to happen, is just a small, small part of your intelligence or what, the mental processing goes on. There seems to be a profound potential within towards healing, towards growth, towards freedom that can unfold more cleverly, more wisely, more healthily if you get out of the way of the inner forces that are moving through us than if you are trying to be in charge and being responsible and in control of the whole situation. So this doing and allowing, it's also a balance of controlling and letting go of control. It's not one or the other. And so meditation is kind of, as you get used to it and get familiar with the territory of it, it's learning how to recognize at different days, different times, where that balance is, and that balance will shift all the time, back and forth, and sometimes you realize, okay, now I have to do more and apply more and just manual labor, and other times you realize the best thing to do is just get out of the way. Best thing to do is to do nothing. Nothing but allow, nothing but be present for what's there, and let something that's not self, something that's deeper within us than self, operate. And so, whether meditation is difficult, or our inner life is challenging, or whether it's quite wonderful, the process is very much the same. And so, the learning of how to meditate, learning of what the skills we're learning, are learned in both directions, both scenarios. So don't worry too much if your inner life is in turmoil and you're using meditation to meet that. It's very profound what you're learning in this process as well. And it's preparing you for later, for the other, what happens. And the other way works as well, that if you're lucky enough to be able to touch in from time to time to these deeper states of like the factors of awakening states, this rising of stuff and learning how to get out of the way and let those things flow through us, that's a very powerful lesson for when life becomes difficult. Someone dies, something, and you have all the grief. And now you know, oh, this is not as pleasant as joy in meditation, but it's a similar process of getting out of the way and this allowing, this trusting, this deeper thing that's going on and happening. And so over our lifetime, we go through all these ups and downs, we go through all these different ways, and all these different ways of being. It's not like a linear path that, you just do this practice and you get enlightened and live happily ever after. If you're a human being, there'll be all kinds of wonderful varieties of feelings, emotions, experiences, states that you come through. And to be free is to be free, be able to let them come through freely. More than needing it to be just, riding on a, coasting along on a cloud nine or something. But it's taking it, letting our humanity, our humanness, come through in a very, very free way without identifying with it, without being caught by it, without being resisting to it, without being attached to anything. But allowing this to come through, allowing. Beautiful thing. So I hope this makes sense, what I said today. If it doesn't make sense, then you probably should just forget it. what I meant by forget what I said. Still meditate. But in 10 years you might come back and try to listen to this talk. And it's because maybe by that time you've pulled out enough telephone book pages, and now it'll make sense. And then I can't help myself, but one more thing to say. If it takes you a year, in the triangle pose, you know, taking those pages off the telephone books to get your hand down. From the point of view of today, a year is far away. From the point of view in a year from now, if you look back over the year, it's a blink of an eye. 10 years can seem like that's forever. That's crazy. Who would ever do, you know, commit themselves for 10 years? But in 10 years, it'll seem like a blink of an eye. That, you know, that it goes. The past seems to go faster than the future. Something like that. And I'm trying to say this as an encouragement. Do it. Give yourself over to the practice. Have some discipline. Just do it regularly. Don't worry about how long it's going to take, because if it feels like it's going to take a really long time, that's only one perspective. When you go through that time, you'll look back and realize, I'm so glad I did it. That was actually, went pretty quick. So, I hope you can enjoy your meditation practice. Thank you.